Welcome to the Cabinet of Science and Fiction. Today, we're diving into a realm that, well, it really shook the very foundations of physics, quantum theory.
It really did. It's a world where things aren't always as they seem at all.
Exactly, where the rules of our everyday experience just completely break down.
Yeah, you think about the clarity of Newtonian physics, you know, everything moving in these predictable ways.
Clockwork universe, almost.
Right. And then suddenly you plunge into this subatomic world of, well, fuzziness and uncertainty. That's the revolution quantum theory brought about, really starting in the 1920s.
And think about the sheer audacity of it. I mean, even Einstein, the architect of relativity.
Yeah, he found quantum mechanics so unsettling, didn't he? He never fully accepted it.
Which is incredible, really.
It is. And look, this deep dive isn't going to be about, you know, drowning in complex equations.
No, definitely not.
It's more about trying to grasp the core ideas of this intellectual earthquake and why it still fascinates and challenges us so much.
We want to explore how this new understanding emerged, right? From those cracks that started appearing in classical physics.
Exactly. Things like the puzzling nature of light and those weird specific spectra you get from elements.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit. For centuries, classical physics, you know, spearheaded by Newton, it gave us what seemed like a complete picture. Deterministic, even.
Oh, absolutely deterministic. You had Laplace.
Right. Laplace famously claimed that if you knew the position and momentum of every single particle at one moment,
you could predict the entire future and know the entire past.
Pretty confident, wouldn't you say? Maybe bordering on hubris.
A healthy dose of hubris, perhaps. It painted this picture of a universe just unfolding with absolute certainty, a clockwork cosmos ticking away perfectly.
But even within that impressive framework, there were, nagging questions, weren't there?
There were persistent mysteries. Like, what is the fundamental origin of gravity? Still a big question, actually.
Sure.
And the nature of light. That was still very much up for debate, even then.
And Newton himself, he leaned towards light being particles, didn't he? In his optics. Corpuscles, he called them.
He did, like tiny streams of particles, yeah.
Miniature projectiles, almost.
But then, fast forward to the 19th century, and you get Thomas Young.
Young's experiments.
Crucial.
His experiments with interference patterns, you know, those alternating bright and dark fringes.
Even seen in Newton's rings, phenomena Newton himself observed.
Right, which strongly suggested light behaves like a wave. It's kind of ironic, isn't it? Newton observing things that would later argue against his own particle theory.
It is, and it's worth thinking about how those interference patterns actually work.
Okay.
When you have two sets of waves, say, from two slits, and they're synchronized, their peaks line up, they reinforce each other, making a stronger wave that gives you the bright fringe.
Constructive interference.
Exactly. But if they're out of sync, a peak meets a trough.
They cancel out.
Right. They cancel each other out, resulting in darkness, destructive interference. And that pattern is just a classic signature of wave behavior.
And the wave theory got a huge boost later in the 1800s with Maxwell, right?
Oh, absolutely monumental. Maxwell unified electricity and magnetism into electromagnetism.
And his equations didn't just describe these forces.
No, they revealed that light was an electromagnetic wave, traveling at a specific speed dictated by fundamental constants.
The speed of light itself.
Exactly. It really seemed like the nature of light was settled, case closed. Wave.
Maxwell's unification was huge, yeah.
Yeah.
It seemed to cement the wave idea. And they even proposed this invisible medium for the waves to travel through.
The ether, yes.
Right.
Permeating all of space, supposedly the substance carrying these light waves. Maxwell himself thought its existence was one of the best confirmed ideas in physics.
Uh-huh. But that ether theory, it ran into a major problem, didn't it?
It certainly did. The famous Michelson-Morley experiment.
Designed to detect the Earth moving through this ether.
By looking for tiny changes in the speed of light depending on its direction relative to the supposed ether wind.
And what did they find?
Absolutely nothing. A null result. Zero difference.
Which classical physics just couldn't easily explain. How do you account for that?
Well, ultimately, it took Einstein's special theory of relativity to resolve it.
Which got rid of the ether altogether.
Precisely. But while relativity was revolutionary in its own right, it still operated within that clear, deterministic classical framework. It was quantum theory that really brought the radical shift in thinking about reality itself.
And it's almost funny looking back. Just before this quantum revolution really kicked off, a young Max Planck was apparently advised not to go into physics.
That's right, because supposedly it was a field where pretty much everything significant had already been discovered.
Talk about a spectacularly bad prediction.
Couldn't have been more wrong.
Yeah.
But even before Planck's big contribution, there were other hints, subtle clues, that the classical picture wasn't quite right.
Like Balmer's formula.
Exactly. Balmer, back in 1885, a Swiss school teacher just fiddling with numbers.
Not even based on a physical theory initially.
No, purely mathematical manipulation. He found this surprisingly simple equation that perfectly described the specific frequencies the colors of light emitted by hydrogen atoms, its spectrum.
It was just an empirical finding. It worked, but nobody knew why.
Pretty much. A strange numerical coincidence, it seemed, like nature was whispering some kind of pattern, but we didn't understand the language yet.
Fascinating. And around the same time, people were trying to figure out the atom itself. J.J. Thomson discovered the electron.
Leading to the plum pudding model.
Right, the idea of negative electrons sort of stuck inside a blob of positive charge, like plums in a pudding.
Or raisins in a cake. Sometimes you hear that analogy, too.
Yeah, but that model, it really struggled to explain those specific spectral frequencies Balmer had found, didn't it?
Completely. There was just no plausible mechanism in the plum pudding model for why atoms would emit light only at these very precise, discrete frequencies. It just didn't fit. It strongly suggested something more organized inside the atom.
And another major headache brewing for classical physics was the ultraviolet catastrophe.
Ah, yes. This came from applying statistical physics, which worked brilliantly for gases and things, to blackbody radiation.
That's the light emitted by an object that absorbs all radiation hitting it. It's like a perfect absorber and emitter.
Exactly. When classical physics tried to calculate the spectrum of light emitted by a black body,
it predicted something absurd.
Utterly absurd. The calculations by Lord Rayleigh and James Jeans suggested that the intensity of the emitted radiation should become infinitely high at high frequencies in the ultraviolet part of the spectrum.
Which obviously doesn't happen. Hot objects don't emit infinite energy in the UV range.
No. It was a serious crisis. The math seemed sound based on classical principles, but the prediction was physically nonsensical. It showed classical physics was fundamentally breaking down when applied to energy and radiation at these small scales.
Okay, so enter Max Planck. This is where he makes his revolutionary move.
It is. To solve this ultraviolet catastrophe, Planck proposed something truly radical, though he was initially quite hesitant about it himself.
What was the proposal?
He suggested that energy wasn't continuous, as classical physics always assumed. Instead, it came in discrete, indivisible packets. Quanta, he later called them.
So energy is granular, not smooth.
Essentially, yes. And the energy of each quantum, each packet, was directly proportional to the frequency of the radiation. Higher frequency meant a bigger energy packet.
That's a massive departure from classical thinking.
Huge. The classical idea was that energy could be infinitely divided. Planck's idea introduced this fundamental graininess.
But you said he was hesitant.
He was. Initially, he wasn't entirely convinced these quantas were a fundamental property of light itself. He almost saw it as a mathematical trick, a calculation tool that just happened to give the right answer for the black body spectrum.
So maybe just a feature of how matter absorbs and emits light, not light itself?
That was his initial thought, yes. He wasn't sure if these energy packets were truly real or just some aspect of the interaction, like finding a key that works, but not knowing what the key is really made of.
And then comes Einstein, 1905. His miracle year.
Annus Mirabilis, yes. The patent clerk with some spare time.
And he takes Planck's quanta idea seriously. Very seriously.
He does. And he uses it brilliantly to explain the photoelectric effect.
Right. That's where shining light on metal kicks electrons out.
Exactly. But the puzzle was, classical wave theory predicted that brighter light, more intensity, should give the ejected electrons more energy.
But experiments showed that wasn't the case.
No. It turned out the frequency, the color of the light, was what mattered for the electron's energy. Below a certain threshold frequency, no electrons came out at all, no matter how bright the light.
And Einstein's explanation.
He realized that if light itself is made of these discrete quanta, later called photons, each carrying an energy proportional to its frequency, EAF, Planck's formula, then the photoelectric effect makes perfect sense.
How so?
An electron gets kicked out only if it absorbs a single photon with enough energy to overcome the forces holding it in the metal. That minimum energy corresponds to the threshold frequency.
I see. And brighter light just means more photons.
Exactly. More photons means more electrons get kicked out. But the energy of each electron still depends only on the energy of the single photon it absorbed, which depends on the light's frequency.
That's incredibly elegant. It just clicks.
It really does. It explained all the puzzling experimental results beautifully.
And it's amazing that while Einstein is most famous for relativity,
it was this work on the photoelectric effect that actually won him the Nobel Prize.
Because relativity was considered too speculative at the time.
Apparently so, which really highlights how radical even his quantum insights were back then.
But solving one puzzle created another huge one, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It brought the whole wave-particle debate roaring back.
How can light be a wave, like Young and Maxwell showed so convincingly?
And also a particle, like Einstein just showed with the photoelectric effect.
Wave-particle duality. It seems impossible. A paradox.
A deep contradiction that physicists had to wrestle with for years. It's one of the core strangenesses of the quantum world.
Okay, so while that debate was simmering, attention also turned back to the atom structure. Rutherford's gold foil experiment.
1911. Another landmark moment. Rutherford and his team fired alpha particles, tiny, positively charged particles, at a very thin sheet of gold foil.
And they expected them to mostly pass straight through, right? Based on the plum pudding model?
Yes, maybe with some minor deflections. The positive charge in the plum pudding model was thought to be spread out, too diffuse to significantly deflect a heavy alpha particle.
But that's not what happened.
Not at all. To their utter astonishment, some alpha particles were deflected at large angles. A few even bounced almost straight back.
Rutherford famously said it was like firing a 15-inch shell at tissue paper and having it bounce back at you.
Exactly. It was completely inexplicable with the plum pudding model. That diffuse positive charge just couldn't do it.
So from this shocking result, Rutherford figured out the nuclear model.
He deduced that the atom must have a tiny, incredibly dense, positively charged nucleus at its center, containing most of the atom's mass.
With the electrons orbiting around it. Like planets around a sun.
Sort of like a miniature solar system, yes.
Right.
That was the picture. The plum pudding model was basically dead overnight.
A huge step forward. But it created a new problem, classically speaking.
A very serious one. According to classical electromagnetism, those orbiting electrons are accelerating charged particles.
And accelerating charges should radiate energy, right? Lose energy.
Continuously. They should radiate electromagnetic waves, lose energy, and spiral rapidly into the nucleus.
Meaning atoms should collapse almost instantly.
Exactly, which clearly they don't. Atoms are stable. So the nuclear model, while explaining the scattering, was unstable according to classical physics.
Another crack in the classical facade. So who steps in next?
Niels Bohr. Building on Rutherford's model and, crucially, incorporating Planck's quantum ideas.
He tried to fix the stability problem and explain the spectra.
Yes. Bohr proposed something quite radical. Electrons could only exist in specific, allowed orbits around the nucleus, not just any orbit.
Quantized orbits.
Quantized orbits, each corresponding to a specific, discrete energy level. They couldn't just spiral inwards.
And he didn't just quantize energy?
No, he also quantized their angular momentum in these allowed orbits. It was a bit of inspired, maybe slightly ad hoc, tinkering with classical rules.
And how did this explain the spectra, like Balmer's formula for hydrogen?
Bohr proposed that electrons could make abrupt jumps, quantum jumps, between these allowed energy levels.
Okay.
When an electron jumped from a higher energy orbit to a lower one, it would emit a photon of light.
And the photon's energy.
Its energy, and therefore its frequency, would be exactly equal to the energy difference between the two orbits, E equals HF again.
Ah, so that explains why atoms emit only specific frequencies of light, because the energy differences between allowed orbits are fixed.
Precisely. It brilliantly explained the discrete spectral lines of hydrogen. It was a huge success.
But it wasn't the final answer, was it? It became known as the old quantum theory.
Right. It was a remarkable achievement, a vital stepping stone, but it was still a hybrid. It sort of patched quantum rules onto a classical framework.
And it didn't work so well for more complex atoms.
No. Attempts to extend it to atoms with more than one electron ran into serious difficulties and inconsistencies. Physicists knew a more fundamental, fully consistent theory was needed.
So the search for the new quantum theory was on. But before that emerged, there was more evidence for photons.
Yes. Arthur Compton's experiment in 1923. Very important.
What did Compton do?
He scattered X-rays off electrons.
Okay.
And he found something fascinating. The scattered X-rays had a lower frequency than the incoming X-rays.
Meaning they had lost energy.
Exactly, which was impossible to explain if X-rays were just classical waves scattering off electrons. A wave scattering should just re-radiate at the same frequency.
But if X-rays are photons...
Then you can picture it like a collision, a little billiard ball collision between an X-ray photon and an electron.
The photon hits the electron, gives it some energy and momentum.
And bounces off with less energy, which means a lower frequency.
So Compton scattering was really strong evidence for the particle nature of light.
Perhaps the most direct and persuasive evidence up to that point for the reality of photons as discrete particles.
Okay, so by the mid-1920s, classical physics is looking pretty shaky.
Riddled with holes. Gaping chasms, really.
Light is both a wave and a particle. Energy is quantized. Electrons live in specific levels and make quantum jumps. Things are getting weird.
Oh, very weird. And then suddenly, brilliantly, the new quantum theory starts to dawn.
Almost simultaneously.
Almost. 1925 and 1926 were just extraordinary years. Annie Mirabile's for quantum theory.
And two key players emerged, Heisenberg and Schrodinger.
Working independently, using very different mathematical approaches, they developed these revolutionary new frameworks.
Let's start with Heisenberg. He developed matrix mechanics.
Yes. Werner Heisenberg, while actually recovering from hay fever on an island called Heligoland.
Good place to think, I guess.
Apparently. Mm-hmm. He developed this formalism focusing on observable quantities, like the frequencies and intensities of spectral lines. His math involved matrices.
Which were not common tools for physicists back then.
Not really. And crucially, matrix multiplication isn't commutative. A times B is not generally the same as B times A.
And that weird mathematical property turned out to be physically important.
Profoundly important. It's directly linked to which physical quantities you can measure simultaneously with precision, as we'll see with the uncertainty principle.
Okay. And then just months later, Schrodinger comes along with wave mechanics.
Erwin Schrodinger, yes. A completely different approach, seemingly. His theory used the more familiar mathematics of wave equations.
And he was inspired by Louis de Broglie.
Heavily inspired. De Broglie had made this incredibly bold suggestion a few years earlier.
What was de Broglie's idea?
He reasoned, if waves, like light, can act like particles, photons, maybe particles like electrons can act like waves.
Wow. Matter waves.
Exactly. He proposed a relationship between a particle's momentum and its wavelength, again involving Planck's constant Planck's, P.E.'s Hall.
Was that taken seriously at first?
With a lot of skepticism. But Einstein saw the brilliance in it. And remarkably, de Broglie's prediction was confirmed experimentally not long after.
How?
Experiments by Davison and Germer in the U.S. and independently by G.P. Thomson in the U.K. showed electrons diffracting, bending around obstacles like waves do, creating interference patterns.
Just like light waves through slits.
Precisely. G.P. Thomson, by the way, was the son of J.J. Thomson, who discovered the electron as a particle.
That's amazing. Father wins Nobel for particle nature, son wins Nobel for wave nature of the same thing.
A wonderful historical irony. So Schrodinger took de Broglie's matter wave idea and built his famous wave equation.
Drawing an analogy with optics.
Yes. Just like geometrical optics, rays is an approximation of wave optics when wavelengths are small. He thought maybe classical mechanics is just an approximation of a deeper wave mechanics for matter.
And his equation worked.
Brilliantly. The Schrodinger equation became the fundamental equation of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. It was easier for physicists to work with initially than Heisenberg's matrices. Schrodinger himself used it to derive the Balmer formula for hydrogen, showing its power.
So for a moment, it looked like there were two competing quantum theories, matrix mechanics and wave mechanics.
It did seem that way initially, but then people like Max Born and especially Paul Dirac showed they were actually mathematically equivalent.
Just different ways of expressing the same underlying physics.
Exactly. Two different mathematical languages describing the same reality. Quantum mechanics.
In Dirac's book, The Principles of Quantum Mechanics became foundational.
Hugely influential. Published in 1930, it laid out the unified structure and principles of the new theory very clearly.
And this new theory painted a picture of reality that was, well, profoundly different from classical intuition.
Absolutely. One of the most mind-bending aspects is the superposition principle.
The idea that a quantum system, like an electron, can be in multiple states at the same time.
Yes. A combination. A blurry mixture of possibilities until you actually measure it.
Which is just completely alien to our everyday experience.
Right.
A cat is either alive or dead, not both.
Right. But in the quantum world, before measurement, the system can be in a superposition of, say, spin up and spin down. It's like it hasn't decided yet.
Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah.
It hasn't decided until we force it to choose by measuring.
That's a helpful analogy, yes. And the classic illustration of superposition is the double slit experiment with electrons,
which Feynman called the heart of quantum mechanics.
The only mystery, he said. You fire electrons one by one at a barrier with two slits.
Yep.
On the other side, there's a detector screen. Each electron arrives as a single dot, a particle.
As you'd expect.
But after you fire many electrons, the pattern of dots that builds up on the screen isn't just two clumps behind the slits.
It's an interference pattern, like waves.
Exactly. Those alternating bright and dark bands, just like waves interfering after passing through two slits.
Even though you sent the electrons through one at a time.
One at a time. It's as if each individual electron somehow went through both slits simultaneously and interfered with itself.
That just melts my brain. How can one electron go through two slits?
It's the core mystery. And it gets weirder if you try to detect which slit the electron goes through.
Put a little detector by one of the slits.
Right? If you do that, the interference pattern vanishes.
Well,
gone. You just get two clumps behind the slits like you'd expect for classical particles going through one slit or the other.
So the very act of looking changes the outcome. It forces the electron to choose a slit.
It seems that way. The observation fundamentally alters the system's behavior. It destroys the superposition that allowed for interference.
Wow. Okay, so we can't form a clear classical picture of what's happening. An electron going through both slits.
Mm-hmm.
It defies intuition.
Completely. And it means quantum mechanics is inherently probabilistic. We can't predict with certainty where any single electron will land. We can only calculate the probability.
The interference pattern shows the probability distribution. High probability in the bright bands, low in the dark.
Precisely. And the interpretation, championed by Max Born, is that the wave function squared gives you this probability density.
And measurement causes this probability to collapse.
That's the term used, yes.
Yeah.
The collapse of the wave function. Before measurement, the electron's probability is spread out. The moment you measure its position, the wave function instantly collapses to that single point where you found it.
Which Schrodinger didn't like at all.
He hated it. Famously called it damn quantum jumping. This discontinuous probabilistic change upon measurement felt deeply unsatisfactory to him and to Einstein as well.
Okay, so how does the theory handle this mathematically? Observables and operators.
Right. The mathematical framework is quite elegant, actually. Physical quantities we can measure, position, momentum, energy, spin, are called observables.
And they're represented by operators.
Yes, mathematical operators. These operators act on the state vectors, which represent the possible states of the quantum system.
And the state vectors live in this abstract space called Hilbert space.
That's right. Think of Hilbert space as the space containing all possible quantum states. Operators transform one state vector into another.
And you mentioned Heisenberg's matrices didn't commute. This relates to operators.
Yes. Crucially, many quantum operators don't commute. If the operators for two observables, say position x and momentum p, don't commute, xpipx, it has a direct physical meaning.
Which is?
It means you cannot simultaneously measure both position and momentum with arbitrary precision. There's a fundamental limit.
Like putting on socks and shoes, the order matters. Measuring position then momentum might give a different result than momentum then position.
Or rather, the very act of precisely measuring one inherently disturbs the other in an unpredictable way, preventing you from knowing both exactly at the same time.
And this non-commutativity leads directly to
Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, one of the most famous and profound consequences of quantum mechanics.
It's not just about our clumsy measurements. It's fundamental.
Absolutely fundamental. It's not about limitations of our instruments.
Mm-hmm.
It's an inherent property of nature at the quantum level. The more precisely you know a particle's position, the less precisely you can simultaneously know its momentum, and vice versa.
There's a trade-off built into reality.
Exactly. An irreducible uncertainty.
And there's a story about Heisenberg discovering this while Bohr was away skiing.
Yes. Apparently, Bohr's long philosophical discussions drove Heisenberg a bit mad, so he finalized the paper while Bohr was gone and rushed it off, maybe to avoid another lengthy debate.
And Bohr found a flaw when he got back.
He did find a subtle issue in Heisenberg's initial thought experiment, but luckily, correcting it didn't change the final mathematical result or the principle itself. It's also said Heisenberg struggled with a related optics question in his PhD exam, which Bohr later connected to the principle.
Fascinating human side to it all. Okay, let's talk more about probability in quantum mechanics. It's different from classical probability.
Very different. In classical probability, like flipping a coin, we usually think the outcome is determined, but we just lack enough information about the initial conditions, the exact forces, air currents, etc.
If we knew everything, we could predict heads or tails. Probability arises from ignorance.
Right. But in quantum mechanics, the probability seems more fundamental, more intrinsic. The calculations involve probability amplitudes.
Which are complex numbers.
Yes, complex numbers, meaning they have both a magnitude and a phase. To get the actual probability of an outcome, you square the magnitude of the total amplitude for that outcome.
And the phase matters.
Critically.
Yeah.
When you combine amplitudes for different ways an event can happen, like the electron going through slit one or slit two, their phases can cause them to interfere, adding up constructively or canceling out destructively.
That's how you get the interference pattern. It's the amplitudes interfering, not classical probabilities just adding up.
Exactly. It's a fundamentally different way of combining possibilities.
Did this lead people to wonder if maybe there is a deeper deterministic layer? Hidden variables.
It did. The idea was maybe the quantum probabilities do arise from ignorance, but ignorance of some underlying variables we haven't discovered yet, hidden variables. If we knew them, maybe things would be deterministic again.
Like classical probability, after all, just at a deeper level.
That was the hope for some, including Einstein. However, John von Neumann famously published a proof claiming hidden variables were impossible.
But the proof was flawed.
Yes. It was later shown to rely on assumptions that weren't necessarily required, so the possibility wasn't completely ruled out mathematically at that point. The debate continues, and there are interpretations like Bohmian mechanics that do use hidden variables.
We'll come back to Bohmian mechanics. But regardless of hidden variables, there's still the measurement problem.
The big one. How do definite outcomes actually happen when we measure a system that was in a superposition?
We measure an electron spin, which was a mix of up and down, and we always get either up or down, never the mix. Why?
And what determines which specific outcome occurs on a particular measurement? The measuring device interacts with the system, its state becomes correlated, but what triggers the specific result?
Has anyone solved this?
Well, there's no single universally accepted solution. There are many interpretations.
Like what?
Some say the question is irrelevant, that QM just predicts statistics for ensembles, not single events. Others suggest the wave function represents our knowledge, so collapse is just updating information.
Okay.
Decoherence is a very important idea. Interaction with the environment makes the quantum system look classical very quickly, washing out the interference terms, though it might not be a true collapse.
Does the system just become effectively classical?
It starts behaving like a classical system in terms of probabilities, but the underlying superposition might technically still be there, just hidden.
Right.
Then there's the Copenhagen interpretation.
Bohr's view.
Largely associated with Bohr, yes.
Mm.
It proposes a kind of dualism. Quantum systems obey quantum rules, but the measuring apparatus is classical.
But where's the dividing line? The cut?
Exactly. That's the tricky part. Where does quantum end and classical begin? How does the classical apparatus emerge from its quantum constituents? It's not fully resolved.
Are there more radical ideas?
Oh, yes. The GRW theory proposes spontaneous, random collapses happen naturally, without measurement. There's the controversial idea that consciousness causes collapse.
Consciousness, really?
It's a minority view, but it has been proposed. And then there's the many worlds interpretation.
Everett's idea. No collapse at all.
Right. Many worlds says the wave function never collapses. Instead, every possible outcome of a measurement actually happens.
But in different universes.
In different parallel, non-interacting branches of reality, the universe splits at every quantum measurement.
This mind-bending doesn't even cover it.
It elegantly avoids collapse, but the price is an unimaginable proliferation of parallel universes.
And you mentioned Bohmian mechanics earlier, the deterministic one.
Yes, David Bohm's interpretation, also called pilot wave theory. It says particles do have definite positions and are guided by a quantum wave. The probabilities arise from our ignorance of the exact initial positions and the wave.
So it's deterministic, but uses hidden variables,
yeah.
The positions.
Exactly. It reproduces all the predictions of standard QM, but it's non-local, which we'll get to with entanglement, and hasn't been widely adopted, perhaps due to its complexities.
So the measurement problem remains a deep puzzle. we can use QM incredibly effectively.
Make astonishingly accurate predictions, build technologies.
But we still don't fully agree on what's really going on when a measurement happens.
That's a fair summary. It's still a subject of active research and debate.
But despite that foundational mystery, QM has been incredibly fruitful, hasn't it? Leading to all sorts of other discoveries.
Immensely fruitful. Take quantum tunneling. The uncertainty principle allows particles to temporarily borrow energy to pass through barriers they classically shouldn't be able to overcome.
Like a ghost walking through a wall.
Sort of. And it's essential for understanding things like alpha decay and radioactivity, how fusion works in stars.
And then there's spin and quantum statistics.
Right. Particles have intrinsic spin, and they fall into two families, fermions and bosons.
Electrons are fermions.
Yes. Electrons, protons, neutrons. They obey the Pauli exclusion principle. No two identical fermions can be in the same quantum state.
Which is crucial for chemistry.
Absolutely fundamental. It dictates how electrons arrange themselves in atoms, forming shells, leading to the periodic table and all of chemical bonding. Life depends on it.
And bosons. Like photons.
Photons, gluons, Higgs bosons. Bosons like to be in the same state. This leads to phenomena like lasers, coherent photons, and superconductivity and superfluidity related to Bose-Einstein condensation.
So these quantum rules have massive macroscopic consequences.
Enormous consequences. Another example is band structure in solids.
How electrons behave in crystals.
Exactly. The discrete energy levels of individual atoms spread out into allowed bands of energy in a crystal, separated by forbidden gaps. This explains why some materials are conductors, others insulators, and others semiconductors, the basis of all modern electronics.
Wow. What about things like delayed choice experiments?
Ah, Wheeler's thought experiments, later realized experimentally. They highlight the weirdness of superposition and measurement even more starkly. It seems like the choice you make now about how to measure a photon can influence whether it behaved like a wave or a particle in the past.
Retrocausality. That sounds impossible.
It's extremely subtle and challenges our notions of time and causality, but it's consistent with quantum formalism. It reinforces the idea that you can't really talk about the photon's properties before the measurement is completed.
And Feynman had another way of looking at quantum mechanics. Sums over histories.
Yes, the path integral formulation. Instead of a wave function evolving, you picture the particle taking all possible paths from A to B simultaneously.
All paths, even crazy zigzagging ones.
All of them. Each path contributes a probability amplitude, and you sum them all up to get the final probability. For large objects, the contributions from wildly different paths tend to cancel out, leaving only the path of least action, the classical path.
So classical physics emerges naturally from this picture for macroscopic things.
Beautifully, yes.
What about quantum chaos?
Quantum chaology. It studies the quantum behavior of systems that are classically chaotic systems, extremely sensitive to initial conditions. It's a very complex and fascinating intersection. How does quantum fuzziness interact with classical unpredictability?
And merging quantum mechanics with relativity.
That led to relativistic quantum mechanics, most famously Dirac's equation for the electron.
Which predicted antimatter.
Astonishingly, yes. The equation had solutions that seemed like negative energy states, which Dirac brilliantly reinterpreted as corresponding to antiparticles like the positron, the electron's antiparticle, which was discovered soon after. It also naturally explained electron spin.
A huge triumph. And that led to quantum field theory.
Yes, QFT. The modern framework where particles aren't fundamental points, but excitations of underlying quantum fields that permeate space-time.
Like ripples in a field.
Exactly. A photon is an excitation of the electromagnetic field, an excitation of the electron field. It naturally handles particle creation and annihilation, wave-particle duality, and even the idea of the quantum vacuum being a sea of virtual particles.
And quantum computing is leveraging superposition.
Trying to, yes. Qubits can be 0 and 1 simultaneously, allowing quantum computers to potentially tackle certain problems exponentially faster than classical computers. It's still developing, but the potential is enormous.
Okay, one last really weird concept. Entanglement. Einstein's spooky action at a distance.
Spooky indeed. Entanglement is when two or more quantum particles become linked in such a way that they share the same fate, the same quantum state, no matter how far apart they are.
Linked out.
If you create two photons in a process where, say, their total spin must be zero, then if you measure one and find its spin up, you instantly know the other one must be spin down, even if it's light years away.
Instantly.
Faster than light. The knowledge is instant, but you can't use it to send information faster than light. Still, it seems like measuring one particle instantaneously influences the state of the other, violating locality.
Einstein hated this. The EPR paradox.
Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen argued this meant quantum mechanics must be incomplete. There must be hidden variables carrying the information locally.
But Bell's inequalities provided a test.
John Bell figured out a way to experimentally test whether reality follows local realism, Einstein's view, or quantum mechanics' non-local predictions.
And the experiments. Aspect's experiments.
Elaine Aspect and others performed increasingly precise experiments in the 80s and since. The results consistently violate Bell's inequalities and confirm the predictions of quantum mechanics.
So the universe is non-local. Entanglement is real.
The evidence strongly suggests so. Reality at the quantum level seems to have this inherent, spooky interconnectedness that defies classical intuition.
So wrapping this up.
Right.
This deep dive really shows a quantum world that's just radically different from our everyday classical experience.
Completely different. Wave-particle duality, superposition, uncertainty, tunneling, entanglement. It forces us to reconsider our fundamental understanding of reality itself.
And it raises huge philosophical questions, doesn't it?
Yeah.
About realism versus positivism. Is the wave function real or just a calculation tool?
Exactly. Heisenberg talked about potential quantum states representing possibilities or tendencies, not actualities until measured. It forces us to be, well, reasonable and keep our concepts fluid when faced with this strangeness. There's no single royal road to knowledge here.
And we evaluate theories based on things like scope, economy, elegance. But there's also a personal judgment involved, isn't there? Polanyi's personal knowledge.
Absolutely. Scientific judgment isn't purely algorithmic. And quantum mechanics highlights holism, the interconnectedness of things, the importance of the environment through decoherence. It challenges purely reductionist views.
The role of the observer also seems crucial, though how crucial depends on the interpretation you favor.
Right. Copenhagen puts the classical observer center stage in defining measurement, while Many Worlds removes the observer's special role entirely.
But it's not all weirdness, is it? Some classical ideas persist.
Oh, yes. Conservation laws, energy, momentum, angular momentum, still hold rigorously in quantum mechanics. And the stability of atoms, which classical physics failed to explain, is a key feature guaranteed by quantum rules. It doesn't all dissolve into fuzziness.
Important point. And a final warning, perhaps, against quantum hype.
Yes. Be wary of misapplying quantum concepts like superposition or entanglement to macroscopic psychology or sociology or mysticism. Quantum mechanics applies to the microscopic world, and its implications for the everyday world are subtle and usually indirect.
So as you can see, this deep dive into quantum theory reveals a world far more bizarre and captivating than our everyday experience might suggest. From the wave-particle duality of light to the entanglement of distant particles, quantum mechanics forces us to reconsider our fundamental understanding of reality.
The questions it raises about measurement, determinism, and the very nature of existence continue to be debated and explored. Hopefully, this has sparked some aha moments and a desire to delve even deeper into this fascinating field.
Thanks for listening.
Until next episode.